From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Netflix is the leading contender at tonight's Emmy Awards, but this fall, Amazon is hoping to get the attention of viewers. Then, The Cake is a thought-provoking play about a Christian baker who's reluctant to make a wedding cake for a gay couple, even though one of the women is a family friend.
It's really easy to judge strangers. I think it's a lot more difficult when you're friends with the person, when you grew up with the person.
And Anna Da Silva from the pioneering post-punk band The Raincoats has some new music. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair. Called inspirational and invigorating by the LA Times, the documentary follows 9 high school students on their journey to change the world through science. ScienceFairFilm.com. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We're going to start today with a prediction. We may very well be at a tipping point in terms of the encroachment of streaming services into our TV viewing habits. Let me explain. Tonight, even before the first Emmy is handed out, Netflix has already won. The streaming service surpassed premium cable channel HBO for the most Emmy nominations for the first time in 17 years. Meanwhile, Amazon has some prestige shows with top talent premiering this fall, and Hulu, Apple, YouTube, and Facebook also have new shows in the coming weeks and months. I Skyped today with Daniel Feinberg. He's a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter, and I wanted to get his take about where he sees the most innovation in TV this fall. And he started with the upcoming Netflix show Maniac. It stars Emma Stone and Jonah Hill and is directed by Cary Fukunaga.
Well, the great thing is I could not describe to you what the plot of the series is at all. It's rather impressive. It is kind of a strange blend of Legion and other things where it's about building on a dream state and people connecting in minds. And I kind of love that this show exists in the form where I can't tell you what it is, because it kind of does say, okay, if you want to get Jonah Hill and Emma Stone to your TV show, you have to give them the chance to do something that's so strange that it's markedly different from what they get in the movies. And so I can say without any hesitation, this is not something that anyone would pour a gigantic amount of money into as a movie. And then audiences who saw it would probably feel really alienated, or at least the mainstream audiences who thought they were getting kind of a super bad reunion. It is a weird show, and it's going to polarize people a lot. And in that way, it's a lot like Kidding with Jim Carrey on Showtime, where it is, this is what happens if you want to get a major movie star to TV in some cases, is you have to say, okay, you can do this strange off-putting thing that you want to do and that you could never do on the big screen. So I like that as a trend.
Amazon is spending a lot of money too. It has a show coming up from Mad Men creator Matthew Weiner called The Romanoffs. It has another series called Homecoming that's adapted from the podcast with Julia Roberts and has Mr. Robot creator Sam Esmail as the showrunner. What's Amazon's plan going forward, and what do their shows look like in the fall?
I think Amazon is in a process of trying to figure out how they can make an impact opposite HBO and opposite Netflix. And if their goal is to be something halfway in between, something more curated than Netflix is, because it often feels as if Netflix is just absolutely everything. More than anything, what they need is a true culture-shifting blockbuster. And so that's why they put a lot of money and a lot of effort into things like their upcoming Lord of the Rings style, parallel, takeoff, whatever it is. We don't know exactly what it's going to be. Why they went all in on Jack Ryan, which premiered a couple weeks ago. You look at Jack Ryan, and that is an expensive-looking show, and it's an expensive-looking show that was ordered for 2 seasons up front. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to get that big splash.
So if you step back and kind of look at what streaming services are doing, and there are new players in that space as well, Facebook Watch, Sundance Now, YouTube, versus what the networks are doing, how clear is there a break between kind of old school, new school in terms of programming choices?
I think there's a very clear break. as to whether it's also clear what the networks think their role is in this landscape, I'm not sure that they do. I think they are still trying to figure out what their space is. I think they know their space cannot be the same space as Amazon, Hulu, Netflix, HBO, FX, et cetera. They're trying to go for something that is broader, something that is more mainstream. But if you look at last season, for the most part, there weren't huge breakout hits. There was Good Doctor, which was a hit. There's carrying over of This Is Us, etc. And looking at the new stuff this year, there's a lot of retreads. So Magnum P.I. is back. This time he doesn't have a mustache. Yeah. The Conners. It's Roseanne's back, but Roseanne's dead. There's Murphy Brown. Murphy Brown is going to speak truth to power once again, but again, we have not seen episodes of it. So I'm curious, and I'm curious every single year whether we're going to get a clearer and clearer idea of what network broadcast TV is supposed to be in this new era. But I don't know that anyone knows the answers, even the people who work for the Big Five.
You talked about how big name talent producers and certainly some actors and writers are leaving both broadcast networks and the feature film world for streaming services. If audiences were to follow as well and abandon their old viewing habits, where would you point them to in the fall?
I think that we've mentioned a couple of them. I think that Homecoming on Amazon, starring Julia Roberts, directed by Sam Esmail, et cetera, is, I think, a very good example of the kind of freedom that you can get in a streaming space. And I've heard terrific things about it. My colleague Tim Goodman reviewed it very enthusiastically out of the Toronto Film Festival. So I think that would be an example. I think The Maniac with Jonah Hill and Emma Stone is an example of where things can go. What happens if you give talented people freedom of expression and say, just come back to us with whatever you come back with. But I don't know that it's going to make everyone happy. And so that's where we are right now, is if you're looking for certain kinds of niche television, it's everywhere. And I think there are a lot of things that are going to be on in the fall on cable and streaming that are going to appeal to a few people, a handful of people, hundreds, thousands, a couple million. The question of where the next 20 million viewer hit is, and Roseanne was kind of that for about a week last year, so we know how that ended. That's what we're watching on a weekly basis.
Daniel, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up, a play at the Geffen Playhouse aims to get people of different political persuasions talking again over cake.
KPCC podcasts are supported by UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting political pundit and cultural raconteur Fran Lebowitz in conversation with Matt Holzman, Sunday, September 30th at 7 p.m. at the Theater at Ace Hotel. A sharp-tongued social critic and keen observer of the irony of human behavior, Lebowitz is often described as a modern-day Dorothy Parker and is known for her sarcasm, wit, and outrageous positions on current affairs and contemporary culture. Tickets at cap.ucla.edu.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. If you're looking for a way to bring people together, food is often a pretty safe bet, but sometimes it can be divisive too. Take cake, or more specifically, wedding cake. A play called The Cake is currently at the Geffen Playhouse. It's about a conservative Christian baker named Della. She's deeply conflicted when asked to bake a wedding cake for a lesbian couple. Her decision is complicated by the fact that one of the women getting married is the daughter of Della's deceased friend. Actress Deborah Jo Rupp plays Della. You might recognize her as the mother on the long-running TV series That 70s Show. Here she is performing an excerpt from The Cake.
This here is my devil's food. The trick is to use the Dutch processed cocoa powder and nothing else. I baked it for 26 minutes at 350, not a minute above or less. Devil's food gets its name from angel food cake, which is vanilla. Add a little chocolate and you got yourself something sinful. But do not be deceived. It's full of angel saliva and good deeds. This cake is not sin. It is a reward. See, I think God made butter and sugar as rewards for us for our good choices, for sticking to what's right no matter how much the world changes, because the world's going to change and we cannot. We must follow the directions till we die. Right? Right? Right.
Back when playwright Becca Brunstetter started writing The Cake, there were several news stories about bakers refusing to make wedding cakes for gay couples. And since then, the topic has become even more timely. In a 7-2 decision in June, the Supreme Court sided with a Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple because of his religious beliefs. Last year, when The Cake premiered at the Echo Theater in L.A., Brunstetter came by the Frame Studios to talk about her play, along with Deborah Jo Rupp.
I decided to be a part of this play because I loved this play from the minute I read it. I read this play for a theater company in New York the week of the election, and I was very, very upset. And this, you know, as Becca has said in interviews, and I've sort of have borrowed it, so I'm going to say it before she does, so I get to sound smart. It was a way for me to look at the other side, sort of, in my world, the other side, to and maybe understand it a little bit, or at least delve into it a little bit.
So, Becca, I want to ask you a little bit about what was happening in the world, what you noticed when you started work on this play.
At the time, I was aware of some of these cases of bakers not wanting to make cakes for gay weddings. It wasn't inspired by any one of them in particular. It was more so inspired by the fact that I was seeing and hearing a lot of vitriol in the world towards conservative people. And I come from a really loving, warm family that has conservative values. And I was starting to feel really protective of them. But I also don't fully share all of their values. So I have this sort of split mind when it comes to a lot of issues. And I just saw an opportunity to write a play in which a conservative character is at the forefront and is not the enemy and is, in fact, the hero.
Deborah Jo, when you were having your conversations with Becca about Della and who she is and her point of view, what were the kinds of things that you talked about and what was important to you in terms of the kind of person she would be, and I guess equally important, the kind of person she was not going to be?
I think the most important thing about Della in this play is to not make her a cartoon character. She is lovable and warm and funny and Southern. And it would be, and she's a baker, and it's a very, very fine line to make her a whole person, but also accomplish everything else at the same time. I think sometimes it's easier to keep your mind open when you watch something as opposed to when it's a member of your family that you're talking to. And so I think watching Della, maybe one thing she says rings a bell.
And I think the way the play is set up, that when we first meet Macy, who is half of the lesbian couple that's getting married, we kind of think that she's onto something, that she's pointing out prejudice and bigotry and homophobia that a lot of people like her would point out. But as the play goes on, she becomes, I would say, a little bit less sympathetic, that she is more strident and inflexible than Della turns out to be. Is that your sense as well?
Well, I think Della, I don't know any other way, it just sounds stupid, but I think Della wakes up in the play. I don't know that she necessarily, well, she doesn't change everything, but she kind of wakes up to a world that she hadn't thought of. Macy, maybe not so much. Maybe Macy's had a very large struggle.
I do think my goal is that by the end of the play, she changes a little bit, too, in the sense that she finds empathy for Della.
Right. She becomes less judgmental.
Yes. And that was my goal for her, because it's not just about Della making baby steps towards opening her mind and heart. It's also about Macy making those baby steps as well.
Deborah Jo, did you want to add to that?
I just, it never even occurred to me that anyone would dislike Della. I mean, like, it didn't even occur to me. Even when I read it, it just never occurred, which I guess is a very good thing. Because if the audience had never had not liked Della, I would have quit. But just didn't even occur to me.
We're talking with Becca Brunstetter. She's the playwright of the new play, The Cake, and Deborah Jo Rupp plays Della in The Cake. Becca, there are conversations in this play that feel incredibly naturalistic, that almost feel as if they're lifted verbatim from conversations that you heard yourself growing up. How much of what you are writing about is inspired by people you knew and the points of view that they shared, even if you found them at the time hard to agree with?
The characters in the play aren't necessarily based on any singular people, but they're definitely conglomerations of people I've been hearing my whole life, like pieces of people that I grew up going to church with, relatives, women I've interacted with at stores. And it's always kind of helpful for me when I'm writing something to not necessarily base a character on one human being, because then you sort of become attached to the character in a way that isn't helpful in terms of the development of the story. But it is interesting how when you're a playwright or I imagine a novelist or any kind of dramatic writer where you're writing dialogue, you just absorb. You absorb the way people talk and the things they say to each other.
Deborah Jo, what is working on a play like The Cake in a small setting as an actor give you that working on a big network series like That 70s Show or something else not satisfy you as an actor?
It's a more complete story to me. It is something that you can just live in for a while. There are pluses for both, but the small intimate theater, you can really, you can feel the people in there with you. And honestly, you really can hear them breathe. It's my favorite thing in the world to do, to start a play. And depending on how they react, you know how this group of people is going to go on this journey with you. And it changes with every single audience. The sitcom land, not so much. I mean, it's really funny and it's good to get those laughs, but it's a whole completely different thing.
This play is ostensibly about a gay couple and it's about a wedding cake, but it feels to me that it's really about dialogue and it's about listening to what somebody else has to say. When you were thinking about writing it, when you're going through rehearsals, when you're actually working on the play itself, did you come back to that idea that this is really a play about listening to other people and listening to what they're saying and try to understand where they're coming from?
Absolutely. I think in situations such as the Supreme Court case that's between the baker and the couple, in that case and in many other like it, these people don't know each other from Adam before they get thrust into this situation. They're strangers. And I think it's really easy to judge strangers and make assumptions about who they are as people. I think it's a lot more difficult when you are related to the person, when you're friends with the person, when you grew up with the person. And I think a lot of people find themselves in that situation where you're sort of off in your life and then you go home for Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, a wedding, whatever. And then here you are with your family members that you don't necessarily agree with. And I don't think that's talked about a lot. And what those holidays and weddings and celebrations really are all about are conversations. And I feel like lately a lot of these family events have been ruined by what's going on in the country. And I just think that there's a way to listen to each other, because especially when you're talking to somebody that you love, that you grew up with, that raised you, you need to listen to them. Just getting angry and throwing in the towel and slamming the door, just for me at least, isn't an option. Like, I'm so not confrontational as a person that I'm sort of forced to stay and listen.
Deborah Jo and Becca, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Cake is at the Geffen Playhouse through October 21st. It's written by Becca Brunstetter and stars Deborah Jo Rupp. Coming up, feminist punk musician Anna Da Silva talks about her music, both old and new.
KVCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Science Fair, the number one audience award winner at Sundance and South by Southwest. Hailed by critics as inspirational and invigorating and supremely entertaining, the documentary follows 9 high school students from around the globe as they navigate rivalries, setbacks, and hormones on their journey to change the world through science. Visit sciencefairfilm.com for more information. Science Fair, in theaters starting September 21st.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn, and now an excerpt from I'm in the Band. It's a podcast about women in punk music created by musician and writer Allison Wolf and The Frame's own Jonathan Shiflett. Today, it's Anna De Silva. She and Gina Birch formed the pioneering post-punk band The Raincoats in the late 1970s. Along with members Paul Molliv and Vicky Aspinall, they set a precedent for feminist music and influenced a generation of do-it-yourself musicians, including Kurt Cobain. De Silva has an upcoming album called Island with the Japanese experimental musician known as Few. It was made almost entirely on modular synthesizers. But De Silva begins with a time that Kurt Cobain came to London to visit her.
When he came to talk to me, I didn't know who he was. Later I found out it was Nirvana. So we never really talked about anything, but he was being really shy and when I listen to your music, I fall on the floor or something like that. I saw these crazy Americans. My name's Anna De Silva. My full name is quite big. It's Anna Paola De Lima Peter De Silva. I'm a founder member of the Raincoats. I was born in Madeira, which is a Portuguese island. It was a small town where I lived, 100,000 people. We didn't have an airport at the time. We didn't have television in Madeira. There weren't many newspapers, and they only came sporadically. So it was very cut off from culture, from other places. It was only when I went to Lisbon to the university that I started having more things to look at and to listen to. And there was also a political system that was very stifling. And then at the end of my course in 1974, there was a revolution.
Censorship was at an end, freedom of speech restored, elections promised, and most important of all, the end of Portugal's colonial wars in Africa.
It's called the Carnation Revolution because the soldiers that were going in the streets had put carnations in their guns. And mainly it was because the army was fed up of going to these stupid wars that nobody was going to win, and that you only lose in wars anyway.
200,000 people took to the streets, strewing red carnations and dancing with the troops.
And the students were making some demonstrations and meetings whereby people would speak about it, and there would be revolutionary songs as well. While I was still at university, my sister gave me an acoustic guitar, and I just sit there in my bedroom playing, you know, John Baez songs and Bob Dylan songs.
Oh, all the money in my whole life I spent.
And a friend of mine used to say, I should go to London and get a band. I just used to think she was crazy saying something like that, because to me that was crazy. And then I came to London, I went to art school, and that's where I met Gina. And at that time, punk started. The thing that inspired us to start a band was the punk idea that you didn't really need to know how to play very well. You just had to have something to say and had the energy to do it. That was one thing. But seeing the Slits playing, and I had heard other women playing things. I loved Joan Baez and Joni Mitchell, but it was a different thing. I never thought I could ever do that. These girls, you know, they didn't know exactly what they were doing, but they had so much to say. Just the fact that they were even just there.
Stop here!
This is for you, I when we started the band, my ideal actually was having two women and two men, because I thought that was the thing that you should strive for. But when we were all women, it was really good. Yeah, after the Raincoats, I did the solo album called The Lighthouse, which was done on a small synthesizer, I suppose, that had lots of sounds in it and the sequencer, and I did the whole album on that. For me, that was a bit like digital punk or something. The modular thing, it's a bit complicated, and you have to. I don't have mates or, you know, friends that do the thing, and you talk about it. I have to read about it and look on YouTube to learn what you do. But basically, you have a wire coming from one, and it can go pretty much anywhere, and that's when the modules relate, which is amazing. So it's not like I have a clear idea of what I'm going to do, but the instrument is giving me something back as well, and it takes over your life completely, because all you can think of is my next module. When the Raincoats went to Japan, we played with this woman called Fiu. The person that took us to Japan, he said, "Oh, you must one day do something with Fiu." I said, "Oh yeah, sure." So I said, "Do you really want to do this? How shall we do it?" She said, "Oh, we could just we transfer." So that's what we did. I do some stuff with this modular synthesizer, recorded it onto my computer, send her the files, then she add more tracks to them, and that's how we did the whole album.
And that is it for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.